I now have the great honor of introducing a very special guest, Boston's Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor Walsh's priorities in his first administration include embracing innovative industries, but also elevating arts and culture in our city. And I think that's something that all of us here can get behind. I applaud him for that. It is my pleasure to introduce, and please join me in welcoming Mayor Marty Walsh.
Thank you very much, Debbie, and I want to thank Debbie for starting the Boston Book Festival. It's an exciting time in our city, and I was saying to Debbie over a minute ago, I was about to give a sermon today in a little while, so I'll try not to go into my sermon mode too much because I know you didn't come here to hear me speak. Unless you want me to go on for a couple hours, I will. I want to welcome everyone to Industries of the Future panel here at this beautiful church. I want to thank the panelists for being here today and our moderator for being here. And I know that this session is going to be very exciting for a lot of people and something that is very timely as far as topics. Each of our speakers are distinguished and experts on the topic. And together they represent the innovation ecosystem in our city here in Boston. And I know that that's starting to sound like a buzzword more and more. We seem to use that. I use that word a lot when I'm talking to groups, but it truly is, it truly has such a real meaning as a word. Our city's economic success and our global reputation is built from our ecosystem. University, research, entrepreneurs, global product leaders, General Electric, thank you for sponsoring this, and thank you as well for choosing Boston to move your global headquarters to this great city. We also have venture capitalists, business school leaders here, different streams that feed into a mighty river, and Boston is a mighty river moving into the future. Our global leadership was built on life sciences, and we did a lot of discussion about life sciences, but we understand the transformative value of this kind of positioning, not just here in the United States of America, but in the world. We've built on that life science. For example, we've created a partnership with cities and towns up and down the Red Line. We branded it the Life Science Corridor. It's the first time, really, that Boston has embraced regionalism. And in the cities that we're talking about, Braintree and Quincy, Boston, obviously, Cambridge, Somerville, and Chelsea, and we think about the strengths of those neighborhoods and those areas. We all have ability to build housing, we all have the ability to attract new businesses to our area, and we have a common thread of the Red Line that goes through the middle of it. And we've talked about not being jealous and not trying to take businesses from each other's city, but how do we build on the businesses that we have in our region and really build it out to something important. It allows us to really look more realistically as a region rather than a municipality. As I go around the country and I talk to other mayors from around the country, they'll often say that, you know, I represent 2 million people in our city, 6 million people in our city. When I think about Boston, we think about us as a city. We have 650,000 people living in our city. But when you think of us regionally, we have over 2.1 million, 2.5 million people living. So it really helps us creating opportunities. In the last few years, we've moved to the forefront in a wide range of innovation industries. Every week, it seems like I'm opening and cutting a ribbon or something like that in new facilities, Autodesk, Flextronics, Continuum, and GE, just to name a few. I'm also looking at the workspaces that these companies have, very different types of workspaces, and they all try to outdo each other when it comes to ribbon cuttings. Last week, I cut a ribbon at Autodesk with a robotic arm, something that was completely new. At Suffolk Construction, we broke ground using virtual reality on it, which was also a very interesting. And then another one, we had a pair of scissors from 120 years ago. I went full circle this week. I went from virtual reality to old-fashioned cutting with scissors. But there's a growing confidence and optimism in the city and our economic future. And I think that as a city, when I think about it, and I look out at the crowd here today, we are a great city. We're going through an incredible transformation. But unfortunately, that transformation is not in every neighborhood in the city either. So it's important for us as a government and as a society and as businesses to really look to see how we can make sure that all the prosperity that's happening in our city can be shared across all the different neighborhoods. I mentioned to Debbie as well before I came up here that it's probably the first time in our history that we have $6 billion worth of development going on in Boston right now. That development in the past, you would say Copley Square area, Fenway area, you'd say Downtown Crossing and the Financial District and the South Boston Waterfront. And today I can add to that list of transformation to Mattapan, to Roxbury, to Dorchester, to Hyde Park, neighborhoods that haven't historically seen a lot of wealth being spent in those neighborhoods as far as on a large scale. So we're starting to see that. So we want to make sure that we continue to not just create opportunities, but continue to diversify industries that we're creating and industries that are going to be created for the future so that our city and these industries can remain resilient. I also work on making sure we create jobs for different skill sets for many people, particularly from research to design to prototypes to manufacturing and marketing. Inventors do things, they imagine what can happen. And here in our city, we really have a great opportunity to build off that. We're investing $75 million in the first ever STEM high school. And that's going to be the Dearborn in Roxbury, and we had the topping off the other day for that. So we're really looking at creating innovation in our schools. We had Innovation Week 2 weeks ago in the city of Boston, where we were able to 6,700 kids across our district really focus on STEM. It's something that we shouldn't be focusing on a week in our school. We should be looking and focusing on throughout the entire school year for our kids, because they are the future here. So I just want to thank you all for the opportunity. Again, I want to thank GE. GE's been an incredible partner since coming to Boston. They made a $25 million investment in our schools. They made a $25 million investment in workforce development and in life sciences. And they've embraced Madison Park High School as one of their schools they're going to be working on. They've also embraced our middle schools. And I was at the old South Boston High School, the Excel Academy, the other day, where they created another program. So I want to thank them for being a great corporate partner in the industries of the future. I look forward to hearing. I know all of you are here. I'm done talking now, and some people will be really happy with that. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Andrew to get us started. Thank you very much. Enjoy the day.
Mayor Walsh, thanks very much for that. Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out today. My name's Andy McAfee. I hang out at the business school at MIT, and I have the really happy duty today to moderate a conversation that involves three old friends and one new one. The new one is to my left. This is Alec Ross, who is a senior policy advisor for several administrations and a scholar of innovation all around the world, author of a book that we'll be talking about in just a minute. Next to Alec is an old colleague of mine, Michael Porter, from my days at Harvard Business School. Michael is probably the world's foremost scholar of industries, so when we're having a conversation about them, it seems more than appropriate to bring him into it. Next to him is a person who I think has one of the coolest jobs in the world. Beth Comstock is the vice chair and head of business innovation for General Electric, responsible for helping that industrial era giant transition into whatever future we're creating. And as Mayor Walsh mentioned, GE has decided to move its global headquarters here to Boston. Beth tells me that's largely because of the Boston Book Festival. And then next to her is the only person that I can think of who gives her a run for the money as far as having the coolest job in the world. Joey Ito is the director of the legendary MIT Media Lab, which is really one of the geek epicenters of the world and a place that has been successfully creating the future for 30 years. We celebrated 30-year anniversary last year. We are here to talk about where the business world is going. I want to ask Alex the initial question on this. Alec, can you talk to us about the industries of the future? The reason I think this is an appropriate question for you is that you wrote a book called The Industries of the Future.
Yeah, thank you. And, one administrative note, I know it's usually poor form to take your phone out when you're in church, but the Archbishop did give a dispensation for this session. So the industries of the future, basically, I think of the moment we're in right now in 2016. It reminds me a lot of 1994 when I graduated from college. When I graduated from college in 1994, I wish I had read a book that said, hey, it's chapter one, page one of the rise of this thing called the internet. Here's how it's going to change all of your lives. I think that the year 2016 is sort of chapter one, page one, for a variety of different fields ranging from artificial intelligence, machine learning and robotics, to the commercialization of genomics, to big data. You know, these are all fields that you can look at either vertically or horizontally that I think are going to have a huge impact in all of our lives at work and home over the next 5 to 10 years. And the book looks at about a dozen different fields and sort of projects. It imagines a little bit what the world will look like. But the underlying thesis to all of it is basically that land was the raw material of the agricultural age. Iron was the raw material of the industrial age. And data is the raw material of the information age. He who owned the land and controlled the land during the agricultural age had the economic power and the political power. He who owned the factories and controlled access to the natural resources during the industrial age had the economic power and the political power. He or she who owned the data, controlled the data, or can harvest meaning from the data are those who I believe are going to create the industries and businesses of the future.
Michael, do you buy this or is this just geek hype? You've been watching business change in industries for decades now. Is there really a big inflection point happening?
There certainly is, but I think we have to sort of understand where we are today and where we're going to have to spend several more decades. I brought a prop today. This is a tennis racket, right? Everybody recognizes this. This is a physical object, and we are going to have physical objects in this world forever. I mean, we need physical things. But this physical tennis racket is a little bit different because in this handle, it's got sensors, gyroscopes and accelerometers. It's got a battery so that it can operate. It's got a microprocessor. It's got a little software running in there. And with your cell phone, you can actually connect this tennis racket to the cloud, what's called a cloud, which is through the internet, a server running somewhere that's collecting all the data that is being generated by this tennis racket as you play. And you can measure, you know, what kind of strokes you hit, how hard you hit, did you hit it in the center of the racket. You can get all kinds of new information about your play from this device and the data it generates. And so what's really happening right now that's particularly unique, and it's built on a foundation that started with a long time ago, but the internet was a big piece of it, we're merging the physical and the digital together. That's what's happened. We're embedding software and sensors and information systems and the ability to gather and collect data inside of physical objects. You'll hear from they make diesel locomotives, among other things. They make aircraft engines. Well, now these aircraft engines are really a merge or a fusion of digital and physical. And part of that is making the physical object more effective and create a lot more value. They can do more. It can be more customized. You can know if it's going to break before it breaks because you can find out if it's overheating or something's going wrong before it breaks. But the device is also generating all this new information. The new data is coming from all these devices that are now instrumented with these sensors and are now can connect together so that all of a sudden we have this tremendous new body of data. But we got to remember, they're still going to always be physical, and it's the ability to connect the physical to the digital and to make sense out of all the new data that we now have. That's the real competitive advantage. So we're not going to have industrial companies go away and be, you know, eliminated. We're going to have industrial companies being more effective than ever. This is going to be the golden age of things. Mm. Things aren't going away, but things can do more, and we can be smarter about how we use things. So it's a very positive step forward for business, but it's hard. It's really hard to do. It's changing what a company looks like and how it operates and what skills it needs. And the competition that is created by this is a different kind of competition that we have to understand differently. So something really, really big is happening. It's not machines taking over for a long time, but it's a powerful new era where the things that we all use and need in the world can be much more effective and much more value creating for us.
Beth, when you look at that tennis racket and you hear Michael talk, does that terrify you or excite you? GE was the master of building the physical objects of the industrial age. Like Michael says, there's this massive transition happening. You got to bring that together with kind of a new skill set. Yeah.
Well, for one, it terrifies me because I'm not a good tennis player, and if anyone had access to the data on watching me play tennis, I'd be mortified. But it also would make me better, and I think that's the point of it. And so it is a bit terrifying if you're a 140-year-old industrial company and you wake up, as we did really 6 years ago, and said, wow, we need to figure out that intersection of the digital and the physical. And why? Why would we care? Partly because, as Michael said, the stuff isn't going to go. The physical stuff's not going away, but it needs to get more efficient. And there's been a lot of efficiency that people were hoping to get from the internet on the consumer side. That really hasn't come to. Some of it's happened, but hasn't. We haven't seen anything yet to what's going to happen in industry, and that's what we started to see. Our customers saying, great, I love that jet engine or I love that locomotive, but really what I need is I need it to move faster. Not because we can't make it move faster, but because there's too much stuff in the system. It's not a very efficient system. So the ability to take sensors and controls and manufacture them inside the hardware, increasingly with advanced and additive manufacturing, it's literally embedded in the material, but to be able to create a data stream that then you can start to analyze and say, oh, if I can give that railroad one mile faster, just 1 mile faster, I can save them $200 million a year. So to be able to take that data and turn it into insights, and it gets really sort of crazy and exciting and scary all at once. The teams at our research labs are creating what we call a digital twin, which is basically a simulated artifact of every machine that we make. And the ability to simulate to know data from the moment it was designed all the way through to manufacture to being worked in the field, the temperature, the frequency, the materials, and to be able to start to over time, this is going to be a while, but start to simulate and be able to predict some things so you know, hey, bolt 4 is going to blow. We better take corrective action before it becomes a catastrophe and shuts our factory down or whatever. So that's really the vision and what got us so excited, but you're exactly right. How do you bring the people together? You don't want to get rid of the great material scientists, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers that make the great stuff. At the same time, you have to bring in data engineers, data scientists, artificial intelligence, and it's an awkward mashup, which I'm sure we'll get to. But it's awkward, and you have to force it through the culture.
If I'm hearing you right, you and I are both keenly aware that American productivity has actually been lousy for the last decade.
Exactly.
It's the single most worrying economic statistic. We're not getting better at being efficient at converting all of our inputs into outputs. Beth, if I'm hearing you right, you're pretty optimistic that the next decade is going to be different than the previous decade.
Because of the data. I mean, we've set a goal that just says if we can just get industry 1% better, it's definitely multiple hundreds of billions, if not a trillion or more, return productivity to industry. I think McKinsey has a statistic that says 82% of industry has not yet digitized. So there's huge, huge opportunity. It's know where my stuff is in a hospital, understand the performance of a jet engine from afar so you can take predictive maintenance, all those kinds of things. Know where my stuff is so I can be more efficient in how I use it is the first phase.
Great. Joey, you and I both know the great William Gibson quote. He says, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. You're in charge of a part of the world where the future is, I believe, farthest along. Can you give us a report from that frontier? What are we not talking about enough yet that's going to be really fantastic?
Well, I think, and I'm trying to remember, I think it's called Amara's law, but there's a rule that says that people overestimate short-term impact and underestimate long-term impact. And I think one of the interesting things about the internet is that we've seen a huge consumer internet transformation, but it hasn't really hit industry as much, I don't think. And GE runs these great snarky ads about industrial internet and this kid that gets a job and sort of makes fun of these other kids that are all into sort of the Silicon Valley app scene. And I think that Silicon Valley's done a really great job of taking that, say, I don't know what percentage, I heard one person say 15% of GDP, that you can do purely digitally and consumer without lots of industry, without lots of science, without lots of math, without lots of HIPAA and all this other stuff. So all the low-hanging fruit starting to get digested, but there's the majority of the world is still there. So it's the bits, it's the hospitals, it's all the really difficult stuff. And I think what's interesting being out here in Boston is you're closer to the government, you're closer to real-world problems, you're closer to industry, you're closer to biotech and to science. And what I think is interesting right now is that the real science, so trying to cure cancer, trying to understand, these are now starting to converge, because it took a while for these sort of older industries to absorb what the internet was bringing. So I think that transformation is just happening, and it really is the big companies and the industrial internet. I also feel that we also see AI, see Internet of Things. There's also things like digital currencies, and there's a convergence of a bunch of new technologies that have to be integrated in a thoughtful way. One of my fears is that it's not just a computer science problem, and I think a lot of people try to solve it because a lot of computer science-based companies have done so well financially. It's kind of the old idea that if they're rich, they must be smart. They built a model that made them a lot of money, but now we have to tie it in a very interdisciplinary way. We have to bring in the social scientists, the lawyers, the doctors, the biologists, and that part, that connective tissue, hasn't really grown yet. So I'm worried a little bit because some of these trends, these things, we're investing in Bitcoin as if it were already a done deal, and it's not. We're sort of deploying AI without really understanding how we're going to do the control. So I'm a little bit worried that some of the pieces are happening in a slightly awkward order.
What does your crystal ball tell you about the time scale for these innovations actually diffusing throughout the boring old-fashioned economy?
So there's a great paper in Nature by Craig Crawford and I think Sister Copa, but she says people are afraid of an artificial intelligence, like a super intelligence, but actually the world is already taken over by dumb machines and we don't even know it, right? And so I think that what's interesting is it's sort of getting into society already in a weird way. I think that AI is weird because it's got probably a dozen or two breakthroughs that need to happen. And you can't predict breakthroughs, right? So that's one of the problems, is that a couple of breakthroughs, like for instance, AlphaGo happened probably 10 years before a lot of people thought it would happen. So it's hard to time that. And it's the same with digital currencies. I think that regulators, a bunch of things could tip something like the distributed autonomous organizations or some weird stuff. So a lot of the breakthroughs, and also in science. So there are definitely mega trends that are happening at sort of a regular rate.
Yep.
But when things happen are hard to predict. Even things like VR. This is like the third wave of VR. I don't know if this is the real wave, if it's the second wave. Digital currencies were really big in the 90s, and then they disappeared, and they're back again. So they also come in cycles, and it's hard to tell exactly when it's going to catch. So that's a non-answer here.
That was a very artful non-answer. I forgot to tell my fellow panelists that let's not have the one-way conversation. Please, if you want to react to anything that anyone else said, let's just have a conversation. Alec, I want you to pick up on a word that Joey used, which is worries. We're painting kind of a happy picture so far about the industries of the future. Is there anything about this world that we're creating that worries you / terrifies you?
Sure. I mean, when you think about, when you close your eyes and imagine the world 30 years from now, do you imagine Star Trek? Or do you imagine Mad Max? And what's interesting to me is I have two very different sets of conversations about this. The conversation I have in San Francisco and Shanghai, it's going to be Star Trek. The conversation I have in West Baltimore or in my native West Virginia, the perception is that it's going to be much more like Mad Max. And so there are things, one thing about my book, The Industries of the Future, it's neither utopian nor dystopian. Most people who write books about the future, it's one or the other. It's, we're going to grow up to be 150 years old, happy, healthy, wealthy, lacking for nothing. Or it's sort of eyes closed, fists clenched, bedwetting dystopianism. And I think
so. Which is it? You're not doing on the
no,
one
no.
hand on the other.
No.
I need a prediction.
So I think that life is going to be far better for the vast majority of the 7.2 billion people around the world. But I do think the exception to this is going to be low skilled labor and high cost labor markets. Let me ask the audience a question. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of a company called Foxconn. Raise your hand.
Okay, sophisticated crowd.
About two-thirds. Raise your hand if you own an Apple or a Samsung device.
Three-thirds.
That's right. So Foxconn makes all your Apple and Samsung devices. And the thing that terrifies me was most animated by the guy who started Foxconn, a guy named Terry Gou. And what Terry said to me, he goes, I have 973,000 employees. He goes, I am sick of humans. He goes, I'm not hiring any more humans. I'm only buying robots. And I said, now wait, Terry, you were one of the pioneers of the model of taking low-cost labor from the Chinese interior, bringing it to the coast, putting it to work in football stadium-sized factories, and then building our electronics for us. What do you mean you're not hiring any more humans? And he looks at me. He goes, humans, no capex, all opex. Robots, all capex, no opex. I'm like, can you unpack that a little? He goes, when you hire a human, he goes, maybe I buy them business cards. Maybe I buy them a computer for their desk. Low capex. He goes, but every 2 weeks they want me to pay them. High opex. And the longer they work for me, the more they want me to pay them. He goes, robots, high capex. They make me buy the robot. He goes, but after that, no opex. He goes, I don't have to pay them a salary. They don't get pregnant. They don't join a union. They don't complain. I can work them 24 hours a day. They are my slave. And then not long thereafter, he fired 60,000 humans and replaced them with robots. And so the worry about, for me, with the rise of technologies that enable labor, that isn't merely manual and routine, the work of men with strong shoulders working in ports, factories, mines, and mills, but also labor that is in part cognitive and non-routine, means that in high cost, particularly in high cost labor markets like the United States, if you don't have skills that map to where job growth will be, as jobs are displaced by ever more powerful technologies, then stagnation is the best possible outcome. So that's what scares me. It's my native West Virginia, and it's my inherited West Baltimore. I worry about those folks.
Michael, you've been hearing some version of this Luddite vision of the future where the next wave of technology is going to take all the jobs for quite a while.
I wouldn't say I was Luddite.
I just labeled your argument, not you.
Okay.
Do you buy it?
Well, you know, we're starting to slip into what I would call highly speculative, very long-term topics. And, of course, I'm much more of a, okay, how do we compete today in industry? But let me just make a couple of points. First of all, you know, we have a relentless ability for technology to do certain kinds of things very efficiently without the need for, labor in the traditional sense. So no question about that. That's been going on for a long, long, long time. Society has not ended yet after hundreds of years of that. And what we've got to keep remembering is that the stuff we do today and we want workers to do today is not the same thing we're going to want them to do tomorrow and the day after that. And this very merging of physical and digital is creating all kinds of new opportunities. So, for example, fairly soon you'll start hearing about the concept of a smart connected yard. And in your yard, there are going to be sensors in the ground. It's going to tell you whether, and that's going to control the watering system. And it's going to tell you if you've got a bug. The camera that you have out there is going to identify bugs if you have bugs on your plants. And all of this new information, first of all, is going to give you a lot of pleasure. You're going to be able to enjoy your yard remotely and see it anytime you want and know when something is there so you can go look. But it's also going to change the kind of maintenance of that yard and the way you take care of it. And it's actually going to create a lot of new jobs because all of a sudden the opportunity for, you know, pleasure in life and enjoying nature is going to go up. So the idea is not that there's a fixed set of needs in the world. The idea is that the needs of the world are constantly evolving and changing and actually expanding. And as we get more efficient in doing more basic things, then we can take on other things. And And when we get into the world of services, we find that it's very hard to replace many services. So I think the first thing we got to understand is we can't see it as a zero-sum fixed pie here. We've got to recognize that these new technologies are creating lots of new opportunities for people to do stuff. The second thing, and this is perhaps less known now, is there's another piece of this digital physical interface, and that is, okay, how does it interact with humans? Okay? And the digital physical interface is creating all this new data that we never had before. Where is this? How is it working? Is it being used 24 hours a day or 6 hours a day? We have all this information. The question is, how do we kind of get that information into the humans? And if we make the human read their computer screen and also look at the physical object, and those interfaces are separate, then actually it's not very efficient. So we've got something called augmented reality. Everybody heard of that? That's the Pokemon Go thing, okay? That's a big deal. Because what that is a new way of kind of getting the information to the human in the context of the physical reality, of the real world. So this is like a heads-up display in your car. I mean, if you're trying to figure out where to go and you're having to look at your screen all the time, you're going to be very, very inefficient in making the choices about how to pilot your little ship. But
and less safe,
and
right?
less safe.
Distracted
and
driving distracted deaths so are up about 10% so far in
right.
America.
And so if
this
you're
year.
Trying to merge all this digital information together with the physical reality of where you are now and the place and time you are, but we now have augmented reality, which you can put on a headset. Pretty soon there'll be mostly headsets. Sometimes you can also do it on an iPad, and you can get physical the information, the data superimposed on the actual physical reality. Okay, and so you can put on your glasses and look at this machine, and it'll show you the machine is overheating. You won't have to read that on the screen and figure out which part of the machine is overheated. You can superimpose. I bring this up because those augmented reality glasses can make a low-skill worker yep. much more skilled. They can allow a low-skill worker to be guided by the information. We're using these now on production lines where workers are, rather than looking at the plans, they're actually being guided by the augmented reality glasses to actually know what to do next and to be very flexible in that process. So if this Boeing 747 needs this set of characteristics and this set of parts, the worker can just instantly adapt to that complexity. Now, you try to robotize that. Massively costly. So I think we need to recognize that there are opportunities being created by this technology, just not risk. I guess that's my high level.
I would add on, I think for industries that certainly our company is familiar with, it couldn't be coming at a better time in some respects because many of these industries, the people are aging out, they're retiring in the oil and gas, in the energy, even in aviation. We don't have as many pilots as the world needs. Oh. And so the reality that industry is being digitized and the kind of skills that are going to be brought, I think is going to be very helpful in some of these industries where today they're having a hard time hiring people trained the old way. But are we training people? That's going to be one of the challenges in companies, in communities. That's why I love Alex's book as a roadmap. I think we all need to get together and say, what are those jobs? How do we all work together, government, business, figure that out? And I would say the other thing is just when you look at robotics and some of those things, we're finding applications to get rid of jobs that are dull, dirty, and dangerous. So these are jobs that, frankly, humans shouldn't be doing them. And the fact that you can send a robot or a drone to do them much more effectively, it creates a higher order job. The challenge is, will people be able to rise to that occasion with the skills,
yep.
with the interest? Are people just going to, sit at home and, play on their video games, or are they going to use the opportunity to raise their skills? There's also a motivation piece of that. It's not just retraining people.
Joy, one of the alternatives to Michael's vision, which is helping people cope with crazy amounts of data, is getting rid of the people altogether and just letting machines cope with the crazy amounts of data. The breakthroughs in machine learning, like you've alluded to, are staggering over the past few years, unanticipated, and taking us into some very, very new territory. I've heard you talk a lot about the need to keep, your great phrase is society in the loop, artificial intelligence. Tell us what you mean by that.
Go to that, but I just wanted to add one thing to the work part, because I agree, and I think that just even without the robots, just on the soft side, just if you could imagine artificial intelligence that, and it's pretty, we're pretty close to there, that knew everything that a doctor needed to know, then a doctor may be just a year or two of community college, and it might be a pharmacist, it might be a nurse, it might be your mom, right? And so the interface of the medical system has this, we call it skilled labor, but it's actually years of torture to turn a human being into a database when in fact you just want the human being to be the interface, you know. And the other thing I think is really important is it's hard to anticipate exactly what's going to happen. So one example is when AlphaGo beat the top Go player, everybody thought, oh, okay, well, that's the end of Go. Well, now Go board sales are up higher than they've ever been. The MIT Go team is twice as large. The AI beat, said that they're now more inspired about Go than they've ever been in their life. And so introducing an AI into even something like Go has rejuvenated the whole thing. And so I think our relationship with the machines will evolve. And we're kind of afraid because we haven't really been there yet. But you see, when you talk to people who've been in self-driving cars, we did a trial in Japan, they all come back and say, wow, that's safer than I've ever felt before. Now that they've experienced it, they're no longer afraid. And I theorize that, you know, that driving will become so much safer with self-driving cars that it's fun to drive will be kind of like the smoking ads. It's just like you couldn't imagine why, you know, we are allowed to kill 40,000 people a year just because it's fun, right? And I think that's sort of the society in the loop part, is that I think society and machines will co-evolve. I think society has to accept things, society will change, but I think we're very resilient. So I'm fundamentally optimistic, because I think we'll find new things to do. I think that I totally agree. I think this what we call unskilled labor, well, moms are unskilled labor, but they're extremely valuable. They're not part of our GDP, but just think about having robots and AIs supercharge mom, right? And how that's going to make the world better. And
not replace, but supercharge.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you supercharge mom, you don't need half the things that kids need these days. And so I think you need to think about the whole society. And so when we talk about society in the loop, the problem is when you take the people who are creating the stuff away from the people who are using the stuff, you end up with stuff you don't really need. And this is a problem. And so what you want is you want mom trying to figure out how to design the AI. You want the factory worker trying to figure out how to augment their job, rather than some. And I apologize for the big industry people, but even the big industry people, you've got people who work on engines, designing the systems that are going to make the next generation of engines. So I think that's crucial. And what's happening right now is that computer science is a very sort of disconnected thing. Yep. And I think what this is a little bit computer science lesson, but when you train an AI, it's a kind of an art form where you collect a bunch of data, and then you tweak the algorithm you pick an algorithm and you tweak it, and you try to train this thing. And the people who train, because it's hard to do this, are basically engineers, they're computer scientists. Yep. And what we're trying to do is figure out a way to have the training done by people who understand the art, whether it's a farmer or a mom. And right now,
so get the math and the database administration out of the way.
Right. And because the problem is that what you do then is you test it against other. So one of my funniest stories that I heard was, like, apparently there are kids that cut like stop sign shaped things out of red craft paper, and they go in front of Google, and junior high kids go like this, and
to, the Google to cars mess with
get
the cars?
All jammed up, right? And the problem is that if something happens that's outside of what the data set has, a machine can't really react to it.
Got it.
And so you need to start to build a relationship between the humans and the machines, and that's, I think it's coming, but so far it's been pretty segregated.
I want to ask each of you one final lightning round question about who the winners and the losers in the industries of the future are going to be. So think about your answer to that. When we're done with this lightning round question, we'll have time for questions from everyone here. There's a microphone up front. If you've got a question, please formulate it and come to the microphone when we're done up here. Very quickly, I will call time on us if we're rambling. Winners and losers of the industries of the future. Alec, you start.
So I would say to start with, I think about 6 billion of the 7.2 billion people on planet Earth will largely be the winners, because I think that with the exception of low costs, with the exception of low-skilled labor and high-cost labor markets, I think that overwhelmingly these technologies are
going to... What about the folk that those remaining 1 billion tend to do things like vote and rise up and...
Yeah,
not like their lot in life.
So this is exactly why I think Donald Trump is a viable president for candidate, right now. I mean, I think that the rise of sort of the lunatic right it can be explained in significant measure. Again, I was born and raised in West Virginia, which is the state where Donald Trump got the highest percentage of vote.
We now return you to your regularly scheduled panel.
Yeah, that's right.
Losers.
The losers are low-skilled labor and high-cost labor markets.
Michael.
Well, first of all, I think there's a lunatic left as well, and I think it's just as destructive. And so the lunatic part is I think our greatest concern right now. I personally believe our biggest problem in this country is our political process that can't actually allow us to see the synthesis and the compromise that we need to actually get things done that the society needs to do. But that's a small detour. I think in terms of the industries of the future. One of the points we haven't really brought up is that what used to be a separate industry is now getting connected to other industries. And so take a farm tractor. A farm tractor now is not just a farm tractor. A good farm tractor that's in this new world is actually able to be connected to all the other farm machines that are operating the
harvesters.
Are you
optimistic that the average farm tractor maker is going to realize that and successfully navigate that
transition?
Well,
they already are.
That
industry is on it, and it's making farms a lot more productive and being a farmer a lot more satisfying and producing a lot more crops with less water and less fertilizer and more productivity. So I think the optimism is even greater when we start to see that we can kind of put what historically have been separate things together, and that allows us to get even more efficiency. So I would say any set of product areas where they're really part of a bigger system and that system can get created, that's going to be a success story in the future.
Losers?
Losers are the ones that get disintermediated. They're the ones, for example, we used to have pedometers.
Mm.
You know, and you could wear a pedometer and see how many steps you took. We don't have pedometers anymore because the pedometer function has been subsumed into a system of other measurements that are going on at the same time. And so you don't need a pedometer. So the power to integrate the physical and digital and add more and more functionality to whatever the physical thing is, I think is creating risk for people that are doing little discrete pieces and don't see this trend coming.
Got it. Beth, with you can't mention GE in the winner category.
Well, I'm going to speak broadly. I think the winners are the ones who are going to be able to navigate that in between, that physical and digital, and the race is on. It means that Google's got to figure out hardware and a G's got to figure out software. And with that comes the ability to navigate ambiguity, a lot less command and control, partnering, appreciating the value of an ecosystem where you don't have to do everything yourself. So the race is on. And I think the losers, conversely, are those who cannot get there, who only think it's, I'm going to take digital and it doesn't matter. I can figure I'm that's all I need.
I've got an app. I've got digital.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep. Joey.
So everyone sort of said most of the obviously things I agree with, but I would look at it as sort of how good you are at learning. So a lot of industries, you sort of learn it and then you're repeating. And what's important is to try to figure out what your core asset is and then figure out where it applies, even if it's in a completely different place. And so you do find tractor companies innovating. You find all kinds of interesting companies that look like they might be disintermediated, but they have learned to learn and they're able to move.
Yeah.
And then other companies that feel like they're obviously going to succeed, but if they stop learning, they'll fail. Because I think what you're seeing is a shift in who gets to be at what layer, and you can pivot if you know what your asset is. And so, and again, I think that I'm going to take a pot shot at education. I think the educational countries that have, like, educational systems that aren't changing. Because education is really about turning human beings into robots. The Industrial Revolution was getting soldiers and factory workers to behave in an obedient, repetitive, boring way. And now we need people to be adventurous, to be different, to be creative. And I think the problem is that the whole idea of a good human being was really something that looks like a robot. And I think the societies that can pivot there, or people who can pivot there, or companies who can pivot there, that's essential. And I think I think that it's not just one category.
We all know that there are three rules for asking a good question in a forum like this. It needs to be short, it needs to be clear, and it needs to be a question. All over the Boston Book Festival today, there are people getting that wrong. We are better than that. Sir, show us.
So mining the big data is the industry of the future. That was the starting point. So when we think about big data, we're talking about putting all that data somewhere.
I need to feel like it's heading to a question.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting there.
But get there quickly.
Okay. So the storage, the infrastructure, that's off somewhere. That's the thing about the cloud. It's tucked away. It's hidden. How can we possibly have enough spinning hard drives, enough electricity, enough neodymium to encompass all of the little blips from tennis rackets and accelerometers and GPS cores?
That's a great question. Are we going to run out of cloud?
Well, I can't speak to that, but I can say certainly in the industrial internet space, you're looking at control and data information happening on premise and in the cloud, and getting the balance of the two. There's going to be certain functions that have to happen in your factory on the side of the machine, and not everything is going to go to the cloud for security, compute power, and a whole host of other regions. But yes, cloud computing is getting bigger.
Joey, are we going to run out of cloud?
Well, I don't think so, but there's a really interesting, you can Google for this, Snowden leak document about the intelligence agencies and how they're dealing with the big data problem. And what they do now is they have artificial intelligence and machine learning, and they just watch the flow and create a model. So AI models take up a lot less space than the data itself. So you don't actually have to carry around all the data and the instructions. You can learn from it. It's kind of like our brains. We don't remember everything, but we remember what we learn from it. So learning actually is a kind of compression technology. And so it is interesting that the intelligence agents are starting to throw out a lot of data because they can just sort of remember roughly that.
The conclusion from it.
Yeah. Oh.
All right, so earlier this week, the Wall Street Journal had this great article about how the tech industry was great at creating wealth, but not very good at creating jobs. Right, they did a statistical analysis and said that tech jobs are actually decreasing pretty significantly. And we talked a lot about how
question
farmers are more productive.
Question.
And the jobs are actually going away. So the question is, how do you actually incentivize companies to create more jobs? Instead of becoming more productive and creating wealth, the incentives are all to have fewer jobs.
Beth, that sounds like a question for you.
Yeah, well, I think it's at that intersection. One kind of job goes away, but another kind of job comes along. I mean, you might get a robot or a drone that's replacing what someone did that was dull and dirty and dangerous, but now someone has to actually operate that drone and figure out how do I program it.
Which is neither as dull or as dangerous as what the
Hopefully.
Drone is doing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I do think new jobs are going to be created, but there's no doubt that there is going to be this bridge of time where we're going to have to retrain and reconfigure some of the jobs. I mean, there's no doubt that we all have to face into that.
Michael, how do we incentivize this?
Before I get to that, let me just say that tech has created a lot of jobs, and it's just that where they were created is the issue. And in America, unfortunately, the Apple created massive jobs, but they were not in America, most of them, except for the really high-skilled ones. And that is something that, it's sad because we have a tremendous company innovating, creating massive value, and yet most of the work was offshore. Why did the work go offshore? Because we've done a crummy job of improving our business environment. We haven't made obvious changes in our infrastructure, our training system, our tax code,
How would you wave your magic wand and improve that environment to create?
The U.S. can be very, very competitive. A lot of these jobs that went overseas could be here, but we have to somehow. I want to get back to the point I made earlier. We haven't had any progress on any of these big economic policy issues in the last 20 years in America because we're screaming at each other and we're gridlocked and we're frozen. And we know what to do to fix our economy. So I don't want us to think that tech doesn't create jobs. It creates lots of jobs. The issue is whether America is an inviting, efficient, low cost of doing business place, and right now we're just not.
Okay, policy guy. How do we create the right environment, right incentives in America for jobs?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to create incentives for the people who we elect to do this work for us to collaborate. And we, as you know, the governed pick the governing.
Okay.
You know, all 535 members of the United States Congress are people who we voted for. And right now, the incentives of the voters are misaligned with good governance, where what we have is the right going far, far, far to the right, the left going far, far, far to the left, and where the governance tends to take place
is
in the middle. It's compromise. There are, God forbid, commas and semicolons involved in the creation of the kinds of policies that Michael is describing, which would actually make America more globally
competitive. Well, give us an example of one concrete policy. Let's assume massive tactically collaboration happened. What would it be?
Repatriating foreign earnings. I mean, there are a couple $1 trillion sitting in foreign banks right now that American companies cannot bring back to the United States, pay taxes on, and use for capital expenditures, you know, building new factories, hiring more people, or other such things, because it's viewed in such an incredibly facile way by people on the far right and on the far left. You know, I do think that we can have a compromise on vast areas of tax policy, but instead, because okay, we paint monochromatically.
Well, nope, I'm going to stop you there because we have many people who want to ask questions. I see I'm being draconian, not just on you on them too.
That's good.
Go.
Hello, my name is Roger. Thank you for being here. I want to ask a question about books because it's a book festival. I recently read Nissan Taleb's Black Swan and changed my mind of how the world works. I'm curious, what is the last book you read change your perception of the world?
Question for a book festival. Lightning round. Go, Joey.
I'm trying to remember. I'm going to go last because I can't
remember. I'm reading a philosophy book right now called How to Live, and it's about Montaigne. And I'm actually...
That's good?
It is good. And the reason I bring it up, because I think I've heard Joey make this point, I do think I studied science. I didn't study philosophy. I think critical thinking and philosophical frameworks and wisdom are going to be really important now and in the future to give us the context we need for decision making. So I'm drawn to that right now.
Michael?
I've been reading books about how the human beings learn and gather information and absorb information and make decisions, because I think that's kind of really on the frontier of how we make this the synthesis between machines and people work.
Is there a title you can share with us?
If I could remember, I would. I read too many.
So those memory books are having a huge impact. Uh-huh.
Yes, they are. They are.
Two books, Originals by Adam Grant and Evan Osnos's book about China, which I think is the best thing that's been written in English about China.
Ready yet?
Yeah, I'm also skimming a lot of books, and I don't want to be too narrow, but I will. I think there's a book called Debt. Is it the 5,000 years or 1,000 years? But it's, I think for me, at least personally, getting to, because we're sort of fish water thing. We all assume money is the way it is, and I think the next big phase around change is going to be sort of reinventing what money is. I think that's going to be pretty important.
I'm going to exert moderator privilege and answer the question because I really love it. The last book that I read that really helped me understand something important was Hillbilly Elegy, which is by J.D. Vance and really explains Scots-Irish Appalachian-American culture in a way that was hugely beneficial to me. Great question. Thank you. Sir?
You all had an interplay between those closer to the future and those farther from it. What do you see as the role of each of the institutions that you represent in connecting that future with smaller lagging players, meaning both consumers and smaller businesses? If it's an active role, what actions, a passive role, what are the incentives?
Great question. Okay, we're going in this order this time. Your institution, what's the role?
Well, I would have to choose my institution first. I'll point to my academic institution, Johns Hopkins. What I would say is that I think that there's an important role for university institutions to make sure that the educational outputs that come from campus map to the inputs that are going to be required over the next 30 to 40 years from the private sector.
Michael?
I remember one of the important titles, Industries of the Future. I would say that in HBS, we are rewriting, in a way, our curriculum, because what marketing is, what production is, what research is, what all the disciplines of business are being changed and significantly by the fusion between machines and digital. And this is something that is very challenging. I mean, in a sense, what management is changing. And what managers need to know is changing. And the appreciation that managers need to have for some of these new technologies is material. So we're having to change that.
Yeah, I think institutions like GE need to make sure there's a good balance of optimizing today and planting the seeds for tomorrow and fighting short-termism. And I think that's what you should count on companies to do. And that means working a lot with startups, working with people who are more freelance, sort of more freelance models, and making themselves more open and accessible. That's why GE's here in Boston, because we want to be part of a broader ecosystem, and you're seeing that model around the world with a lot of companies.
So the Media Lab, we used to use a phrase, demo or die, and I changed it to deploy or die. And then President Obama said, maybe you should drop the die part, you know. And
just deploy.
We have almost 90 companies that are members of the lab, including GE and Lego, and they're all over the place. And we also work with all the disciplines. And to your Bill Gibson quote, I think everybody has something that's ahead of everybody else. And so our job is to connect those people that don't normally connect. So connect the computer scientists, connect Lego to GE, because
there's no place better at that than the Media Lab. You are the connectors of the academic world.
We like to think so, but I think that's really how do you connect? Because the problem is not so much about the future; it's the future pointed in the wrong direction, right? So it's more about making sure that you get feedback loops.
Because I love your question so much, I'm going to answer it as well. MIT is my institution as well. The thing that we can and should do is take our world-class educational materials and make them available for free to everybody around the world over the internet. That is happening. It is the most heartening, one of the most heartening trends that is going. All right, I'm sorry to put pressure on you. This is the last question.
That's great.
It needs to be a bang-up final question. Ready?
Is there a way to have our industrial era economy adjust in a way that these new abundancies will happen as a result of these new technologies so that we can abandon the 40-hour work week, abandon the way that we look at economies and the exchange of economy under our current capitalism, and look at ways that this new free time that we'll all get also would reward us, allow us to grow as human beings, and also be able to make a living at the same time?
Wonderful final question.
So I would say yes. I mean, as we move from the agricultural age to the industrial age, we went from a mean work week of 6 days to 5 days, from 12 to 13 hours a day to 8 hours a day. And there's no reason as we go from an industrial age to an information age, we can't continue to make progress against that. What we will need, though, is a new social contract. We had a social contract during the feudal days. We had a social contract during the industrial age. Where we have tensions today is where we try to graft elements of our industrial age social contract onto the information age.
The mark of a good question, I told you, was that it was short, clear, and a question. All of our people did a wonderful job. The main job of a good moderator is to end on time. Thank you all for coming. This has been fantastic. And thanks to our panelists.